Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review, who is also the author of The Weed Agency. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Three martinis for you today. And Jim, just last week, everyone was buzzing about the razor-tight Mississippi Republican Senate primary between Thad Cochran and Chris McDaniel. A lot of people surprised at how strong McDaniel did there. Not nearly as surprised as they were last night at the results of the Republican House primary in Virginia's 7th District. There had been very scant polling, which is very hard to do in House districts, but it looked like Eric Cantor was going to fend off his primary challenger, Dave Brad, as it turns out, with pretty decent turnout for a primary in a state where all the other primaries got pretty lousy turnout. Dave Brat not only beat Eric Cantor, the sitting House majority leader, but he beat him by double digits, about 56 to 44. This is a race where Cantor badly outspent Brat, about $5 million to about $100,000. This is being chalked up to a whole lot of other things. It's always fun when no one expects something to happen. The punditry suddenly still has exactly the reasons why it happened, Jim. So tell me why it happened.
This piece of evidence confirms that I am right about everything all the time. Yeah. No, something like this really re-energizes your interest in politics. Because let's face it, it had been, by and large, a fairly predictable primary season for Republicans. You know, Nebraska gave us some interesting surprise. The quote-unquote establishment guy won in North Carolina. Mississippi's going to a runoff. But really, this was the metaphor that kept coming up last night was an earthquake. And it fits because, you know, the House Majority Leader almost never loses. And he almost never loses in a primary. And he almost never loses in a primary to a candidate almost no one has ever heard of when he's outspent him 40-1 until last night. And showing that nothing is guaranteed in politics. No incumbent should ever take anything for granted in this thing. And so the question, you're right. So this morning, everyone is actually, well, obviously, if you believe in a comprehensive immigration reform deal, you need to explain it away. And you can look to all these other factors. If you, oppose a comprehensive immigration reform deal, a.k.a. referred to as amnesty, then this is all the vindication you could ever want. And it's a sign the Republican base is mad as hell about this. And Eric Cantor is, the first scalp of potentially many. And effectively, most people concur, this effectively eliminates any possibility of any immigration deal, certainly for the remainder of this cycle and probably for the remainder of Obama's presidency. He will try to do this stuff through executive order and stuff like that. But there is no way a Republican is going to sign on to an immigration deal with Barack Obama. If the illegal immigration issue had not occurred, it's really tough to believe that Barack would have won without that kind of galvanizing issue to get people really excited. I think that the deluge of unattended illegal immigrant children coming across the border and creating this humanitarian crisis in our Texas and our southwestern states is a – I have a hard time believing that didn't really kind of focus everyone's minds on the issue of illegal immigration to an extent they weren't doing in, say, May or April or February or March. Now, there's a strong argument to be made that, Cantor, wanting to be Speaker of the House someday may have taken his eye off the ball in terms of taking care of his district. Hugh Hewitt noted that Cantor did not do a lot of conservative media press, did not do a lot of talk radio, was not a guy who was doing a lot of outreach to anybody outside of the, GOP donor class. And I think you can also safely say that, everybody who worked on his campaign this year is going to be, have some explaining in every subsequent job interview because they clearly took Dave Brat for granted. You outspend a guy 40-1. You should not lose. Then you got to wonder, where was all that money spent? How did they misjudge the turnout so badly? His internals had him up 30. Now, it's kind of a little slack observing that it's hard to poll in House districts. It's hard to poll in primaries. And it's really hard to poll in a primary where there hasn't been a competitive race in a long time. The last time around, Cantor was running up against a no-name, and he had about 70% of the vote. So it's not surprising that the polling was tough, but the fact that Cantor just got so completely blindsided by this indicates that he was really ill-served by his campaign staff on this one.
Now, Dave Brat had an explanation for why it happened. Here's what he told Sean Hannity on the Fox News Channel last night.
If you go door-to-door knocking, the American people know the country is heading in the wrong direction, right? I mean, the debt and the deficits, the economic growth is terrible. The regulatory burden is terrible. and the representation in D.C. won't address those major issues. And so I think the people are just ready for some major changes in this country.
Jim, we always see these congressional approval polls and the numbers are just horrific. And especially when each party controls one chamber, they say, wow, if you're a Republican, it's because they hate what the Democrats are doing. If you're a Democrat, well, they hate what the Republicans are doing on the other side of the Hill. It turns out possibly here that people just don't necessarily care that much. They just know things aren't getting done.
Probably true. The interesting thing is that last night also gave us a nice piece of counter evidence of Lindsey Graham avoiding a runoff and winning about 60% in his primary. Now, some of this I have emphasized, and I've been saying this since the very beginning. If it's Lindsey Graham against three big names, you know, I'm really lowering the bar when I say big name, but let's say three noticeable, you know, challengers and a couple other no names. Dave Brott was not trying to compete with two or three other guys trying to say, hey, look, I'm the Tea Party guy. In other words, what Brott worked in that district, but I think the first thing I say is he definitely out-hustled everybody. It's probably easier to do this in a House district than it is in across statewide. Lindsey Graham put a hell of a lot of effort into building bridges to conservatives. And, you know, listeners know that my folks live down in Hilton Head and then in Beaufort County. Lindsey Graham was down there meeting with the groups and you know, taking the criticisms. You know, people will give you a lot of credit if you show up and ask for the vote. And you talk about why you're voting and what you do and all that kind of stuff. And it paid off for Lindsey Graham in a way that just didn't happen for Eric Cantor. And you got to wonder, you know, did he kind of let the ball, you know, drop on that aspect of being an elected representative?
Exit question here, Jim. Obviously, in the, if you want to use the word establishment versus Tea Party primaries, when the establishment candidate wins, there's always the expectation, okay, you had your voice against us, we heard you, now make sure you're in line for November. From what we've heard, the NRCC did not issue a statement following last night's results, and following the Mississippi primary last week, they said, we're all in for Thad, which I guess he's still the incumbent, so that's kind of their policy. But do you think groups like those will be actively getting behind these guys come November?
Well, the first question is whether Dave Brott will need them. This is still an R+10 district. This isn't a district that in normal circumstances is going to vote Republican. I think you'll probably see a bunch of polling in this district, you know, more extensive polling in this district to check in to say, okay, Dave Brott is largely unknown. We have to see how Dave Brott is as a candidate. It's kind of interesting that he's a university professor and his Democratic rival is also a university professor at the exact same small college outside Richmond. So I think that's going to make the faculty meetings a little bit tense.
All right, on to our bad martini for today. And this one's really bad. This is from the Wall Street Journal. So much for Al-Qaeda being on a path to defeat, as President Obama used to be fond of boasting. On Tuesday, fighters for the Islamic State of Iraq and Al-Sham, an Al-Qaeda affiliate known as ISIS, seized total control of the northern city of Mosul with nearly 2 million people after 4 days of fighting. Thousands of civilians have fled for their lives, including the governor of Nineveh province, who spoke of the massive collapse of the Iraqi army. And whoever wrote this article then says this could also describe the state of the U.S. policy in Iraq, talking about how things were pretty stable, casualties were going down until there was no status of forces agreement, and things have only deteriorated from there. You've got the radicals from Syria and so forth. And so, Jim, when you think of everything we invested in Iraq and how quickly this is unraveling with Anbar and now up in Mosul in the northern part of the country, this couldn't be a worse martini.
Yeah, I mean, the simplest way of putting it is that it looks like Iraq is starting to, you know, decline into a state of civil war, not terribly different from what we're seeing over in Syria. During the worst years, let's say 2005, 2006, 2007, pre-surge Iraq, there was the argument from the Joe Bidens of the world that this was a country that was, you know, entirely a creation of the old British Empire, that the Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish regions were just too inherently divided. I don't know if that necessarily this is what's fueling this divide, or whether it's Al-Qaeda-esque Islamist types or just splinter groups and militias and warlords and all that stuff. But I think it's just safe to say that, look, we have left Iraq, and the attitude of the American people is, okay, we're done. It's not our problem anymore. Well, the death toll there is climbing and ratcheting up, and we may be seeing the collapse of the government. And that's a sign of, like, look, you can get out of a war, but the consequences that follow may end up being worse for American interests than the continued presence there. And you got to wonder about the safety of our embassy, safety of our people out there. This is a very bad development in Iraq. I'm not even sure we'll get much coverage of it here in the United States because American people are just so tired of Iraq, they just don't even want to pay attention to it.
Yeah, and that's disappointing as well. All right, on quickly to our final martini and back to what appears to be pretty good news. and that is the Florida governor's race. A few months ago, it was a 12-point lead for former governor, Republican-turned-independent-turned-Democrat Charlie Crist over the incumbent Republican Rick Scott. But according to a new poll from Public Policy Polling, which certainly leans to the left in their ideology, if not their numbers to some extent, now says it's a dead heat at 42-42. Even better, they look at the favorability numbers in this race. 32% see Crist as favorable, 48% view him unfavorably. The numbers aren't great for Scott either, at 39% approving, 48% disapproving. But the idea that Charlie Crist was going to waltz into this due to Scott's unpopularity is clearly not looking to be the case.
Rick Wilson, who's a very sharp, funny GOP political consultant down in Florida, who looked at that poll result and just described it as, oh, that's why I didn't like that guy, response of the electorate. You know, when Crist left office, he did not have particularly high approval ratings. He has since switched parties and reversed all kinds of positions and claimed, really, I've always been, you know, pro-choice and, you know, and all kinds of position shifts that are just not all that plausible. But he'd been out of the spotlight for a while, other than those seeming to us ludicrous hackneyed advertisements for that law firm down in Florida. And so he comes along, and most people will admit that, you know, Charlie Crist is a good retail politician. He comes out there and he talks about how moderate and sensible he is and all that stuff. Well, over time, as you get back to a campaign-style environment, you stop being this, you know, beloved former governor, and you get back into the process of campaignings, you do have that impact of, oh, that's right. Oh, I really don't like that person. He's a pain. And that's kind of what you know, the suspicion of what's happening in this one, that the numbers are coming down. Any Republicans who may have had kind of soft, you know, vague, fuzzy feelings are deteriorating. And oh, by the way, you kind of wonder whether we'll see it impact that kind of a dynamic at work with Hillary Clinton, because, you know, Hillary Clinton in the 2008 campaign had numbers that were not spectacular. She becomes Secretary of State, a position that's traditionally kind of seen as above the fray and, you know, representing America as a whole, not necessarily, you know, broad, not against involved in partisan politics. As she slides back into the world of partisan politics, any Republicans who feel warm and fuzzy towards her are going to see that evaporate. And I think a lot of independents will see that those numbers shift. And, you know, maybe some hardening of the numbers amongst Democrats as she becomes more likely to be the Democratic nominee. But basically, campaigning generally doesn't make people like you more.
Yeah, fascinating. Just fascinating politics all over the place today. Jim, we'll come up for oxygen at some point today. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please join us again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.